Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
This week on Meatin' 3, we're exploring the culinary wonders of urban New Jersey with a tour through Newark. We speak to Frank Mentisana at Phillips Academy Public Charter School.
This idea of family style and made from scratch lunches continues to be a bit of an anomaly in the city.
We also hear from Gil Speyer from All Points West Distillery.
Newark used to have an incredibly rich beverage alcohol history.
And we'll tour Aero Farms, the world's largest indoor vertical farm.
We're growing using 390 times more productivity than field farming and 95% less water.
Tune in to this week's Meatin' 3 on Heritage Radio Network to be amazed at the wonders of Newark. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every Italian supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Jeff Sirati, the author of Sakepedia, a non-traditional guide to Japan's traditional beverage. And Japanese sake is becoming popular in the U.S., which is now the biggest importer of national beverage of Japan, but it is hard to find an easy and fun guidebook of sake. But Jeff's book is very handy for someone who is curious about sake, for both beginners and connoisseurs. So today we'll discuss why Jeff wrote the book, what you can learn from the book, and what he learned himself from writing the book, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about the topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Now let's start a conversation with Jeff Sirati. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Hi, thanks for having me, Akiko. I really appreciate you having me.
Yes, I was so excited. So first time I got the book in my hand, usually one of those books, and I skimmed everything through.
Because, oh, wow.
Yeah, it's so unique. You just cover everything, even including yeast.
I try not to get too technical about it because, that can be a real snooze when people are talking about microorganisms.
Yeah.
But I feel like, people need to have at least some fundamental understanding of that part of it. So I wanted to make sure I included that, but in as fun a way as possible.
Yeah.
Without getting too sciencey.
Right. So the point is, though, that even if you just never even tasted sake, you really enjoy it. And also, it's kind of like a little story book, too.
Oh, yeah, so. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that really led me to write it, was because so few people in this country, sake is growing here, but, it's a very, very small part of the alcohol market. And I think the main reason why it's so, generally unknown is because people don't know what to make of it. People are intimidated by it. they don't even really understand it. And I've been places where people aren't even aware that it's made from rice. Mm. So they just think it's this weird thing with a lot of writing on it that they can't understand. So they're going to stay away from it. But once you taste it, once you drink it, and there's so many different styles, but you know, if you take a basic style, it's very, very accessible on the palate. I think it's probably an easier beverage to like, you know, let's say somebody has never tasted wine before, nobody's tasted beer or sake, and they wanted to try something. I truly believe if sake is the first alcohol beverage that they have, I think they will fall in love with it. But unfortunately, it doesn't have the market penetration that those other big beverages do.
Right. Yeah, something like, you know, wine, to me, even like, you know, diving into really cool, refreshing swimming pool or something, but the sake is like a blanket.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is like a blanket, and it's also it's comforting in that way too. I find it, and there are different sakes that I drink for different sort of occasions. You know, if I really just want refreshment, I'll go for something fruity and floral, like, you know, a ginjo. Or if I want something that just is exploding with really intense flavors, I'll go for a junmai, especially if I'm pairing it with like meat or something like that. Mm. So I think there's something for every occasion, there's something for every palate. And I also feel like there's also a misconception that sake's flavor is very, very narrow, and that's not true at all. I mean, it's basically as broad as wine and beer and other beverages. It's maybe a little more nuanced, but there definitely is a very wide spectrum of flavor notes that you're getting.
Mm. Well, I really respect your comments, because you have, it's not just sake, you're an expert of all the beverages. So let me asking you about your background. So where are you from originally?
Well, I mean, I grew up in New Jersey. I lived in, you know, northern New Jersey for most of my life. I lived in Jersey City until about 4 years ago, and now I live in the Washington, D.C. area. And I used to be the editor of a magazine called Beverage World. I started there just over 16 years ago, and that's when I really started to immerse myself in beverage writing. But I was writing about all beverages, alcohol and non-alcohol. And, you know, I was there as senior editor, then I got promoted to editor-in-chief, and I was editor-in-chief for about 8 years. And I just sort of fell in love with not all beverages, but sort of the alcohol side of the business. I mean, I had to write about the non-alcohol side, but I really did gravitate towards the alcohol side. First, it was beer. I was almost exclusively enamored of beer. And then I started, then I got into sake, and then I got into spirits. But sake was just the one that, I don't know if it was because so few people knew it or because I went to a lot of Japanese restaurants, but I just wanted to learn more about it and learn as much as possible. So then, you know, after leaving Beverage World, I started, I was freelancing, writing exclusively about alcoholic beverages. And then, you know, I started writing some books. I did The Year of Drinking Adventurously, then Beer FAQ, and then The Drinkable Globe. And then I pitched the sake book to my publisher. I'd pitched like a number of different book ideas to them for my next book. And that was the one that I think that they were going to want the least. But then they turned around and they were like, no, we want the sake book. And I was thrilled, because it was the one I wanted to write about the most. Because my other books, I hadn't really focused exclusively on one type of beverage. It was a lot of different beverages, with the exception of beer, but beer was a lot of different beverages too. Mm. So I was really excited to do that.
But why do you think, you know, publisher changed their mind to focus on sake?
Well, I think it was just as simple as the owner of the publishing company, like the editor called me, and they said, the owner, yeah, he loves sake. That's what he wants. That was it. I mean, I don't think there was a market strategy behind it. It was just, yeah. And, you know, he kind of saw it as like, oh, I want this to be something that you can update, and we can do different editions of it over after a few years and that sort of thing. Because he saw a potential on that front from a market standpoint. But I really think it was just, he just loves sake. So it was, which was, you know, good for me.
Right. You hit the right publisher. So.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, it's interesting, right? Because there are so many now sake experts, you know, John Gottner.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, raised so many experts. But when it comes to books, it's hard to find a good English books. So,
yeah, I thought that that was the one thing that I really I wanted to make it. And then that's where sort of the non-traditional part, where I call it the non-traditional guide to Japan's traditional beverage. It's because I want to have that approach where the approach of making it approachable, where I want it to be, I don't want there to be any pretense about it. I don't want any of the language to be, you know, stilted or academic or anything like that. I just want it to be, I want to take the reader along on my own journey that, you know, in my own discovery of it and how excited I am. And I hope my passion for it comes through because I'm trying to be inclusive and I'm trying to make more people like sake. Whereas, you know, in some, and I'm not saying this is true of all wine books, but there is a certain sector of wine writing where it's very exclusive. It's very, you need to be in the know, you know, it's sort of, I don't want to use the term elitist, but I'm not saying wine is elitist, but certain sectors of wine writing, it's mainly to be exclusive.
Aristocratic. Yeah, versus the
exactly. Yeah. If there's like a beverage aristocracy, need to come up with a term, but that's what it is. And I didn't want that to be, I wanted beer drinkers and I wanted wine drinkers, to come to sake. That's what it was. And I try to make it appealing on both fronts because, you know, obviously sake has got a lot more in common in beer than people realize. And it's a lot, it's not a wine, even though people call it rice wine, but there are certain flavor elements that might be appealing to somebody who likes white wine and that sort of thing. So I really want it to be about, you know, hey, here's a really fun beverage that you can learn. And it's an exciting journey.
Right. So, you know, knowing that you know all the other types of alcoholic beverages, what is so special about sake? You know, you said the flavor diversity and approachable aspects of it, but is it the occasion that's so versatile, or?
Yeah, see, it's the whole package. You know, there's a certain ritual to pouring it. There's, it's the fact that it does pair so incredibly well with a lot of different foods. So, you know, for instance, most of the time you're going to find it mostly in Japanese restaurants or general Asian restaurants, like in the US. I mean, not a lot of non-Asian places carry sake as far as restaurants go. So by default, you're really going to be drinking it with Asian food, even though it pairs amazingly well with all kinds of Western foods. But the great part about it was that it paired well with so many things that it was hard to have a bad pairing. You can, like for wine and even beer to some extent, you can have a pairing go horribly wrong. It just doesn't work. Now, sake, some things pair better than others with it, but there's really no food pairing that's a complete failure with any style of sake.
So forgiving.
Forgiving is the term, yeah.
Right. Well, this is a kind of like, you know, just throwing this question. I wanted to always ask you since I read your book. So why do you think people drink alcohol?
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, there's so many reasons, right? Social, taste, relaxation, of course, like intoxication.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, the thing is, and I'll take it from my own experience drinking alcohol. My relationship with alcohol has evolved since, you know, I've been drinking, let's say going back to college, and whether, you know, I'm not going to say what age I was because it wasn't legal. But, right. Yeah, in college, it's all about intoxication. I didn't care what I was drinking. And I was drinking the cheapest beer that you could find and whatever. I got a little older. You know, you get in your 20s, it's like, oh, I need to start drinking some grown-up beverages. And then I was like ordering things like gin and tonics and whatnot. And I was trying to learn more about wine, but, you know, I really wasn't doing such a good job. And then in my 30s, I was at Beverage World, and that sort of accelerated my own appreciation for things because I was learning a lot and being exposed to it at trade events and through press releases and things like that. And people were sending me loads and loads of free product. So then I gravitated towards beer, and then I realized wow, this is great. Beer can taste phenomenal. So now it's going to become about the journey, the flavor, the sort of the drinking ritual. And that's kind of how I've personally, that's my reason for drinking. Like, yes, it's a social thing. It's a discovery. It's like, I want to, you know, I'm known for, if I'm out drinking with people, a lot of times they'll have like three beers and I'm still on my first. And I'm the same way with sake. I'm the same way with everything, because I'm just sitting there just thinking about every sip. You know, I'll be writing down what I'm thinking, and it's just, I just want, this is all part of my journey. It's all part of that ritual. It's all part of that social experience. And so for me, that's what drinking is. Now, I mean, a lot of people share that, and I'm sure that, but you know, people drink for different reasons, but I think it is the flavor. It is the adventure. It is, just the comfort, and you know, and it does relax you too. Mm. So that's sort of, I don't drink to the point of intoxication now, but yeah, I will start to feel a little more laid mm-hmm. back and relaxed when I'm drinking.
Right.
So
I think socially people tend to punish kind of the act of drinking sake, because people drink for the sake of drinking, not yeah. knowing why. But I realized myself, like, when I know the history or background of sake or wine or anything produced, I sip more slowly and think about it. So it's more about, I mean, I can just maybe have a nice cup of tea
yeah.
in tea bag, which may have great history, but I really appreciate that fermented flavor, that nuance, and it's different depending on which bottle.
Oh, yeah,
vintage
yeah.
diversely, and kind of like I feel romantic about it.
Yeah, and it's just so much history and tradition in it, that, and really any alcoholic beverage, and I think that no other non-alcoholic category really has that. Like when you're talking about non-alcohol beverage history, you're talking about soft drinks. Okay, late 19th century. That's how far back they go, mm-hmm. you know, because mainly because for the longest time, most people weren't drinking non-alcohol because the water would kill you. So that's why alcohol exists. Right. So, I think it's that. It's the history. It's your tradition. You're just thinking about so much, and you just want, it just raises so many questions, and you just want to learn so much more with every sip that you take. And that's the way that I think. I mean, that's the way I drink, and it's just, I think that people should drink. And I don't drink for the sake of drinking. I you know, if I specifically want something that I know that I'm going to enjoy, or if I haven't had before and I want to discover it, I really want every sip I take to be an adventure.
I can't agree more. Yeah. So by the same token, it's important to know the background of what you're drinking. And now let's talk about your book.
Okay.
So the title is The Sakepedia, A Non-Traditional Guide to Japan's Traditional Beverage. And it's non-traditional guide, but it's very traditionally covered too. So I really appreciate it. So what can we learn from the book?
You can pretty much learn everything from what exactly sake is to which sakes go with which foods, you know, to, you know, there's history. You can't write a book about sake without writing history. So there's a little bit of that, you know, and there's a little bit of geography too, because sake is very regional. So I try to highlight the major sake producing regions and what their sort of local traditions are, what their local flavor profile is. You know, not everybody necessarily has a very specific flavor profile, but you get to a place like Niigata and it's very, that whole refreshing crisp, you know, it's just the notion of like mountain sake, because you think of snowy mountains and that's sort of the flavor profile of sake you get. So you kind of, you can't think about sake without thinking of it in the context of its geography as well as its history. So it's a little bit of everything. And I also have, you know, there are a few things on there. Like I do profile some new American sake producers as well, because there's sort of a burgeoning craft sake movement here. So I highlight some of those. It's not comprehensive because they're opening up every day and some are closing. So it's sort of, so there's that. And then there's also, I highlight some of the, my favorite places to drink sake all over the US. And, you know, I do talk about my travels in Japan as well and places to drink there, but I wanted to make it accessible for the American drinker so they don't actually have to leave the country to have really great sake.
Right. I think that's kind of a psychological barrier. It's been existed because it's a really, you don't understand what's written on the label and it's really far away, which is kind of this mystery part that's attractive, but by the same token, why then do you have to drink here in this country, right? So, yeah, I really think it's really comprehensive, but not just, you know, you introduce the, say, type of sake, and this is what it is, you explain so well, and also examples of what kind of sake that you can actually try and taste it, so... Yeah, and I was impressed how comprehensive the book is. So how did you gather all that information?
From a lot of different places. I mean, some of it was from traveling in Japan. Some of it was from, I took a sake class with the Sake School of America. I got my sommelier certification through them.
And, wow.
I took two classes. I did both levels that they do, the sake advisor and then the certified sake sommelier, or Kika Sakeshi. So I did that. I traveled, not just traveling in Japan, but I travel all over the U.S. as well. So I always sort of gravitate towards the best izakayas and places like that to really discover it. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in Portland, too. And Portland's got, supposedly, nobody's actually verified this number, but they say that it's the highest per capita consumption of sake outside of Japan in Portland. So Portland's got some great places like that. So it's really, and the best part about that is Portland, unlike a lot of other places, just about anything you can get by the glass when you go into a restaurant, whereas in a lot of other cities, you have a couple house sakes and then the rest is by the bottle. And most of the time, people don't want to have to commit to buying a whole bottle, especially sometimes they're like $72 for a bottle. So I think that's been a real barrier to sales. But a place like Portland, you can really try a lot of sakes without really having to commit to a bottle, especially if you're alone. You don't want to have to buy a bottle if you're alone.
Right. So is it because there's a sake one that's an Oregon, the local winery, and the sake brewery, and also that's the culture of the wine country. Maybe you enjoy everything by the glass.
Yeah. It's they really... I think they've had a really good effort, too, from the importers and distributors who've trained... basically account by account, you know, how to serve sake and how, you can serve it by the glass because, I mean, one of the biggest things, like, yeah, they do have like a huge wine culture out there, but sometimes that has gotten in the way because, yeah, people are so incredibly well-versed in serving wine. They think sake has... for lack of a better term, the same shelf life that wine does. So for instance, if you open a bottle of a red wine or whatever, you know, you pretty much, you're opening a fast mover. You're going to empty that bottle before the end of the night because you can't really keep it that long or it's not going to be good. But with sake, you can open a bottle and as long as you're keeping it at the right temperature, you can have that bottle open for like 3 months and it's still going to taste exactly the same. So you don't. Restaurants don't have to worry about. Oh no! If we open this, we have to sell it by the bottle because we're never going to be able to finish this bottle off if people are buying it by the glass. But you know, you open it, and if people are buying the glass of a 720-milliliter bottle over the course of 3 months, you can easily empty that bottle.
Right. Yeah.
So, and that's the one thing they have to sort of unlearn. And when I say they, I mean the restaurants and bars. They need to unlearn some of the things they've learned about wine because the same rules do not apply to sake.
Right. Well, it's a big advantage of sake, right? Because I get the bottle of sake and it's, of course, you can't finish. So, and then I think sometimes the glass tastes better in 3 days later or something.
And yeah, change. Well, the thing is, like, you're also, it could be, you could have had something different to eat that day that may still be lingering, and that could be giving you a different experience. I mean, every time you drink anything, I've never tasted anything that tastes exactly the same the second time I had it. And I think just a lot of it has to do with circumstances, the environment, the mood you're in, you know, it could be any number of factors. So,
right, that's true. So, but I didn't know that that specific Oregon or Portland is the sake.
Yeah, it is. It really is, and it's. I'm actually flying there again tomorrow. So,
oh wow, yeah. Awesome. So, but also you visited Fushimi, the Kyoto area.
Oh
and
yeah,
Niigata too. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you just made an appointment?
Yeah, I reached out to some friends. Have you had Jamie Graves on the show?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I reached out to him, and he had just started working for Skernick at that time, and I said, hey, I'm finishing up my book, and he's interviewed in the book, and he actually helped me a great deal on the book. And I said, you put me in touch with anybody that, you know, you can sort of just show me around, maybe just let me in a couple of sake breweries. And then he reached out to his contact in Niigata, who basically put together an entire itinerary for me. And,
yeah,
you know, people welcomed me with open arms. They just let me and my wife was with me. We just walked. We've toured, got the really, really extensive tours. We had dinner with them, and it was just so that was just a fantastic experience. So
actually, Niigata, you know, they have an annual sake 2-day event.
Oh yeah,
right, like $20, and then you can drink as much as possible. There are like 90 breweries attending, participating, oh, and per brewery they have like 2 or 3 labels. So,
oh wow,
there at outside there's an ambulance waiting for just in case. But it's
and it's all you can drink.
Yeah, but I think that event connects annually closely all the breweries in the prefecture.
Oh yeah,
and of course they developed the specific Niigata Tanle, like you mentioned earlier, like cleaner, yeah, crispier sake. So that's like a regional. It's beyond terroir. They have,
yeah,
like a community feeling in Niigata. And of course, this sake is so high quality too.
Well, one thing that was interesting going to a lot of the places in Niigata is a lot of the brewers were intent on producing something that didn't necessarily fit with the Niigata style. Like every time I sat down, they'd be like, this one has a little more umami to it than a Niigata style. It's because I think they're really, part of that has to do with, like, for instance, also say, like, this one pairs well with a hamburger. And part of that has to do with they recognize the U.S. market as a major export market since, you know, consumption has been on this slow, steady decline in Japan. So we're probably their top market outside of that. So, you know, they want to differentiate themselves and they want to make it more appealing to, you know, the types of foods that we hear and everything like that. So it was more of like a marketing decision than anything else, but it was interesting because almost everywhere I went, they were the sort of the recurring theme was this one is not the Niigata style. This one has more umami, and this is, you know, this goes well with hamburgers. It was sort of the key
well,
thing.
Well, in other words, though, that the global market really is inspiring traditional industry, and then, you know, the traditional sake producers are waking up like, oh, wow, there's a demand for like sparkling wine is a good example, right? And I think sparkling sake is becoming popular in Japan as well. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's always good to have this global inspiration and stimulus.
Oh, yeah, no, it's I mean, I just love that. You know, I love that the U.S. market is helping keep the Japanese market going. I mean, I think that more people need to discover it because I loved visiting those breweries that have been in their families for 6 generations, and it's and the fact that, you know, I always kind of see this kind of boomerang effect that happens. It happened with beer where the country of origin influenced what was going on in the U.S. That's how craft beer was born. And then in turn, those countries, you know, mostly Europe and whatnot, they started adapting some of those traditions that Americans had adapted themselves. So so now I hope to see that happening in Japan where, you know, the American market wakes up, and then it drives the home market again, and the new generation of people in Japan start to gravitate towards sake again.
Right.
I think I've already seen it happening, because you know, just the people that I've gone out drinking with there. So it's kind of I've seen an embrace of it, which is exciting, because like, you know, you hear it a lot, and this is like with every category. It happens here with bourbon and gin and everything else, where it's like, oh, that's what my grandfather drank.
Yeah.
So for a while in Japan, I think it was similar to that, wasn't it? Was it people just kind of like, oh, sake, you know, my parents, my grandparents drink it. I'm more into beer. I'm more into whiskey now. So I think, but I think now younger generations start appreciating more what goes on, what went on with their grandparents, great grandparents were drinking. So
right. It's actually a cool drink.
Yeah, it is.
Right. Okay. So, so let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk, hear Jeff's thoughts on artisanal sake breweries outside Japan. So please stay with us. It's like a 1 minute. Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table, so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Are you enjoying our podcast? Heritage Radio Network has lots more. I'm Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And together we host Why Food, a podcast about innovators, career changers, and entrepreneurs who are changing the face of food.
How did these folks decide to hit the brakes, start over, and become inspiring chefs, entrepreneurs, farmers, and activists they are today?
Browse episodes of Why Food wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Broadcasting Live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Jeff Soretti, the author of the Sakepedia, a non-traditional guide to Japan's traditional beverage. So we've been talking about traditional and modern kind of transition. So in Sakepedia, you quote words from Sakewan, the Oregon-based breweries, and the CEO says the traditional Japanese brewers tend to think, make the sake and hope people like it, versus figure out what the consumer needs, make a sake to fit that need, and make a label to reflect that. So do you agree that that's still the mindset of traditional sake brewers in Japan?
No, I don't think. I mean, I think my sort of view changed a bit when I visited a lot of them, because as I was saying, you know, earlier, I think that people are making things with an eye towards changing markets and changing palates and different cultures in different countries. So I think they're more attuned to diverse tastes. I mean, you know, back in the day, you know, for instance, you're in Kyoto or Niigata, you know, your sake didn't really travel much beyond your region, so you were really just making it for those palates. You know, and now the market is a lot more complicated, it's a lot more global. Even throughout Japan, tastes are so varied, and I think that they're just more attuned to what changing demographics want. And they still make, you know, the sakes that made them famous, their own, you know, whether you call them a flagship or whatever, that's they're still making those, but they are branching out more with different flavor experiences. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't think it's as, it's not as sort of narrow as that once was.
Right. So do you have any examples of, you know, more progressive, open-minded style of sake brewers?
Oh, boy. let's see. I think someone like Kimonoi. And a lot of these are going to be in Niigata because that's where I spent the most amount of time. And I'm going to butcher the names. I'm not going to pronounce them right. Tame no Hikari, is that right?
Yeah, Tame no Hikari. Right.
Yeah, I think they're doing great things. And now I can't remember who the brewery is that makes Cowboy Yamahai. Do you know that one?
No, I don't.
It's in my book, and I should know this. It's slipping my mind at the moment. But the brewery there, that is something that is just a, I mean, just like the name suggests, you know, Cowboy. Mm-hmm. It is a wild sake, right. And I first had that in the train station in Niigata, and have you ever seen these? This place called Panchokan. It's a, what do you get, like 100 different sakes where you put in a coin and then you'd get a taste and everything.
Yeah.
So that was the first time that I had it. And and I've been happy because I've been seeing it a lot more in the States. So it's, I'm glad for that because it's in the book and people, but you know, it's killing me that I'm not remembering the name of the brewery.
Well, you wrote the book a long time ago, so. Right. But actually, how long did it take? Like 2 years to?
Okay. It took about a year to write it. And then there's revisions and things like that. And, you know, between the researching, the writing, and the revising, yeah, it was probably about 2 years.
Yeah, right. So, because you have to travel a lot. So.
Yeah, so.
Right. Okay. And you also introduce in your book non-traditional ways to enjoy sake, including cocktails. Like, maybe you can just tell.
Oh. full disclosure, I'm not a fan of sake cocktails.
Okay.
You'll notice that the section was very short, but I felt like it had to be in there because they do exist. Sake cocktails do exist, and you know, I'm a traditionalist when it comes to drinking sake. I don't want anything in it, you know. But you know, the things like, you know, Sakatini is the easy one, and there are different iterations of that. I mean, some are more sake forward, others are more gin forward, some don't have any gin in them at all. Sometimes it's just sake and umeshu that you'd pour in place of the vermouth. So it's just like things like that, and because you put it in a martini glass, you call it a Sakatini, but it bears very little resemblance to it.
Right.
But you know, you do some where it's like, you might have 1 ounce of gin and 2 ounces of sake, and then you still have the vermouth in there too. So, I mean, something like that. My thought on sake cocktails is, as long as the flavor of the sake is still coming through, and it's not one of the more you know, delicate or more nuanced sake, then yeah, I mean, it's fine to put in a cocktail. And I embrace it from the standpoint that when you look at spirits, for instance, the way most people, you know, first discover spirits is through a cocktail before they become somebody who drinks something neat. So you can say the same thing about sake. It's like, if this is going to be their way into sake, where they try it in a cocktail, it comes through in a cocktail, and they're like, okay, now I want to try this on its own, then that's great that cocktails are able to do that, the bartenders are able to do that. But I feel like the end game needs to be getting people to appreciate sake on its own rather than, oh, I've got this new sake cocktail that is my new go-to cocktail, but I have no interest in drinking sake on its own.
So right. I think it's like, you know, like a spicy tuna roll kind of thing.
Yeah.
Before you get to the edamame, you know, real sushi.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, you're not doing the uni quite yet.
But right. It's yeah. So, yeah, I think... you know, it's always nice to have a nice entrance door, right? But so I really want to ask you about, you know, sake breweries in the U.S. Now they're more in Europe too.
Yeah.
Outside Japan, there's sake breweries like, you know, Brooklyn Sake. And so what do you think about them?
I think there's some amazing stuff happening here. And it's a very recent phenomenon. I think, with the exception of Sake One, it's always been making amazing stuff. I truly believe that Sake One is the sake brewery that it's the gold standard of American sake breweries. It's like, that's, I think everybody should be striving to be as good as they are. That's kind of been my feeling. And then for a while, they were pretty much the only game in town that was really doing anything any good, because a few breweries have come and gone and some weren't making very good stuff at all. And so I didn't really have high hopes for a lot of new sake breweries. But in the past 2 to 3 years, I've finally tasted stuff with people who've opened up in the past 2 to 3 years that are doing incredible things. I mean, and I'll name names here with some of my favorites. Brooklyn Quarter, yeah, of course, they're incredible. I'm using that word incredible a little too much. Brooklyn Quarter, I would also say Sequoia in San Francisco. They're doing really good stuff. Proper Sake in Nashville. That they're just phenomenal. And I don't want to forget anybody. Who else? I know there's one more that I usually go to. Moto E or Moto I think it's I thought it was Moto E, but somebody tried correcting me saying it was Moto I in Minnesota.
I thought it was Moto E.
Well, I assume they were using a Japanese pronunciation, so right. The person who corrected me could have been wrong. It wasn't somebody from the brewery, but
okay.
But in Minnesota they're really good as well. So they're starting to pop up in different places, in unexpected places too. Like, I would have never thought one of the best sake breweries in the country is in Nashville, you know? So.
Right. Yeah, it's a, you know, the craft beer trend, like you said earlier, sake is more close to beer.
Yeah, exactly.
So, like, and everybody's talking about now fermentation, and it's kind of a good extension from craft beer to sake.
Absolutely is, right? Yeah.
It's a little more complicated process.
I think you also get a lot of former beer people getting into sake brewing. You don't seem to get as many former wine people doing it. And you don't, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you even do have some breweries that make a sake, or they'll do a beer with sake rice, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
So there's definitely a kinship there. And also, you know, just there's an appreciation for the role that the microorganisms play, whether it's the yeast or the koji. And especially when you get some of the brewers who are like real fermentation geeks, you know, they'd never worked with koji before. And so it's just, the sort of the prospect of that is probably something that also pulls them in the sake. So
koji, my prediction, it's going to be a big deal.
I hope so. I hope, because I think that I want it to be enough of a big deal here where you've got, you know, the yeast labs that are supplying to the brewers start having that in a big way, so they don't have to keep sourcing it from Japan and whatnot. So I think that once more and more of these breweries start, I think we'll start seeing more of a koji, I won't say koji boom, but, you know, just a kind of a growth and, you know, just a market for koji here. I think we probably need at least 20 or 30 more sake breweries to open up in the U.S. before that happens.
Right. Okay. So, you know, it's a lot of work to write that book, and I really appreciate your great job. What did you learn through the process of writing Sakepedia yourself?
Well, one of the things that I learned was to forget everything I had learned before. Because there are a lot of myths and misconceptions with sake, and I spend a lot of time trying to dispel those. But I had my own misconceptions, too. You know, for instance, it's not necessarily just Junmai and Futsushu that you can drink warm. There have been times when I've had Daiginjo warm. You know, I've had Ginjo warm. And it's from the brewers themselves. They'll taste, they'll like, here, taste this. And then they'll have a little kettle on the fire, and they're like, okay, warm this up a little bit. Now try it. And these are really, it's hard to pigeonhole one particular style of sake. It's like, and to make a blanket statement about this needs to be warm, this needs to be cold. And I think that just kind of blew my mind, because I had my own misconceptions about it.
I think depending on the vintage or the type of rice they try, and they realize that, oh wow, and you know, that's the warming sakes, kanzake, have different levels of temperature. So it seems like they were playing with the temperature and how they serve. So
well, I mean, especially if there's more umami in it. I mean, you know, the sort of traditionally, and you can make generalizations about, you know, Junmai, Ginjo, Daiginjo. You know, generally a Daiginjo is going to be delicate and floral, and Ginjo, you're more often than not going to find it to be on the fruity side, and then Junmai, you're going to find it to be on the umami side. But you know, I found Daiginjos and Ginjos with lots and lots of umami in them, and heating it up, actually, an umami forward sake benefits from heating, because it opens up. It's succinic acid, I think, is the acid that actually responds well to heating. Whereas you can't heat something that's fruity or floral, that's going to destroy the flavor. But if the dominant note is umami, you can heat it and you have a completely different experience.
Oh wow, so it's a good with entree, more heavy.
Yeah, exactly.
Umami oriented. Oh wow, that's good to know. So, okay. So how do you predict the future of sake in, you know, the global market? I think
I think it's going to keep growing. I think 10-20% globally. I think it's going to level off in Japan and start growing again soon, because it's declining, but it's declining like 2-3% a year. It's not a huge decline. And as I said, as more younger generations start to reappreciate it, I think it's going to start to swing up in Japan as well. So I can see, you know, between 10-20%, 15%, I think is going to be the year-on-year growth. And I also see you're going to start having more breweries in countries you would not expect. I mean, like, we've got one in Mexico now. You know, Mexico City has a brewery. It's like one of the last places you expect to make sake, but Mexico City. And, you know, there's one in Canada. Somebody was telling me, I don't know if somebody told me there's one in Italy, or I'm confusing it with something else, but they're starting to pop up, and you know, they're not huge by any means, but the fact that people are embracing it, and people are embracing it in non-traditional places, and making stuff that's as good as some of the stuff coming out of Japan, I mean, I think there's a real future there. It's just, I can't stress the need for education enough and people familiarizing themselves with it, because that's the biggest barrier right now. It's just education.
Yeah, I'm concerned about the declining number of sake breweries. I think people say the operating ones are only around 1,000.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
So, and I think a lot of them produce sake only once a year, seasonally. But if the demand increases, they can... I heard there's one brewery that they're like mom and pop, young couple. And this, I guess, started to become very popular. So they started to switch to twice a year production.
Oh, yeah.
And they have to adjust everything because it's, you know, the summer temperature. But their business is sustaining. So I think the demand goes up, even if there's no more, you know, sake breweries by number. But if the money goes more flow into each brewery, the industry grows, stays stronger.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, yeah, the vitality, I think we have to maintain.
Yeah, I mean, you'll see, you'll probably see consolidation among some breweries more than you will see any breweries actually close. So I think that's what ends up shrinking the numbers. And but as you know, if that demand starts to pick up again in Japan, we might start seeing new breweries opening up just as they are here, like in various places. I mean, I remember the sort of the in Niigata, we were seeing some of these breweries at 400 something years old, and then we went to one, we opened 100 years ago, they said, and we're the babies, you know.
Yeah. So. Right. I didn't know that all those are the increasing number of mergers and acquisitions.
Well, there have been some, yeah. I mean, some, I think in a lot of ways you'll have breweries buying other breweries within their regions and stuff, and I mean, it's you know, it keeps them, keeps their brands alive, keeps them viable in any way that they can do that, that's great. I would rather see them keeping their beverages alive than, and some of them actually too have started making craft beer. They still make sake, but there are some that have doubled up and have been making craft beer to satisfy that growing need.
Right. So yeah, financially they're supporting themselves. That's great.
Yeah.
So I know you're doing a lot of stuff. So are you gonna keep following sake?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I you know, again, I'm still touring with this book. Again, I'm going to Portland to do a couple of signings for it, and because there aren't a lot of people writing about it, I feel like this is something that I can really specialize in. Like, I sort of left beer writing because that's too saturated. Everyone's writing about beer, and I don't think I have anything new to tell. The beer writers are doing amazing jobs doing what they're doing, and I don't have anything new that they don't already know. So but sake is somewhere that I can really, really specialize in. Sake is always going to be the beverage that's close to my heart. So if the more I can write about sake, the better. If I could think of another idea, I would love to do another sake book.
That'd be great.
Yeah, but I just have to think of it. I have to think of a specific angle that's marketable. So that's
right. Yeah, well, keep me posted.
Well, thank you.
And also, cool. I think the younger generation of sake, you know, like how many generations ago they started the company, but younger generations utilize more social media.
Oh, yeah.
And come to, you know, global market to sell in person. So I think that's a big future. Maybe you can work with them.
I hope so. Yeah, right? That'd be fantastic.
Yeah. Okay, so what's your plan? I heard you're working on something new as well.
Oh, well, as far as a couple things, really. I am, I just took on a new role as the editor-in-chief of a digital magazine that the American Craft Spirits Association is launching. I'm on staff now at the American Craft Spirits Association. We're hoping to get the publication up and running by the end of June. So that's all about spirits, craft spirits. And then I just finished another book called Drink Like a Geek, and that's coming out in September. So, and that's more of like a pop culture drinking book.
Okay.
So it's kind of the geekier side of drinking, whether you're into Star Wars or Star Trek or The Walking Dead. I mean, it's sort of the crossovers there with drinking. So really? That'll come out. But yeah, my big project right now is getting this magazine up and running. So
Right. So, and also, I think you make short films as well.
Oh, yeah. Wow. You really did your research. It's been a while. I mean, I do still do travel drinking videos, like whenever I can. It's been several months since I've put one up, and I have a lot of footage that I need to edit that hasn't been edited yet. So I want to keep doing that. That's sort of been my filmmaking outlet lately. You know, the Drinkable Globe was my website, so I do Drinkable Globe videos. But before that, I made like one feature film. I made a bunch of documentaries. I made a bunch of short films and stuff like that.
Wow.
But it's been that sort of filmmaking. It's been nearly 10 years since I've done that. But
oh, wow. You're having a lot of fun.
I am.
Yeah, that's like, it's great that you love what you do and that's how things come out.
Yeah, no, that's key, because, you know, it's, you got to love what you do, especially if you're not getting rich off of it. Like, I'm not, so.
Well, you're rich in your heart as well.
I am, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so where can we find your updates, like all those things that you're doing?
Okay, you can, well, my website is drinkableglobe.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter, and that's at Jeff Cioletti. My name is spelled C-I-O-L-E-T-T-I. On Instagram, it's drinkableglobe. Again, keep an eye out for the American Craft Spirits Association digital magazine, which doesn't have a name yet. So hopefully within the next couple of weeks, we're finally going to have a name. All the usual social media places. I think I'm always posting updates. I do Instagram stories on Drinkable Globe. So that's really the best way to find me.
Okay, so I'll keep my eye on you, and then I'll be...
Oh, I forgot I have a podcast, too.
Okay, oh, yeah.
Could I not
mention? That's right. That's right. I listen to them. Yeah.
I forgot my... Yeah, I'm really good at promoting myself. I have a Drinkable Globe podcast. Mm. Ideally, it comes out every other week. Sometimes I push that a little bit, but the idea is it's every other week. It's just, I try to do drinking tied in with travel. So it's like drinking with a sense of place. So I talk to a lot of people in the drinks world and, give me thoughts on where they're from, places they've traveled, that sort of thing too. Mm. So, I've done about, 17 episodes of that so far, and that's been a lot of fun. You can also find that you can get it on the website, but it's also on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud. So it's kind of
I listened to a couple episodes. It's like like a cool talk, you relax, and it's really fun. So all right, so
well, this was fun too.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, you have to come back.
Oh, I definitely will. Thank you.
Yeah, so but thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been amazing.
Yeah. All right, so listeners, Jeff's book is not just informative but fun to read, so I highly recommend to check that out. So again, the book is The Sakepedia, a non-traditional guide to Japan's traditional beverage. And where can we buy the book?
Oh, all the usual places. I would say, if you want to get it online, I'm a fan of going to IndieBound because they support small independent bookstores. But, obviously, if you wanted to save a little money, you can always go to Amazon, and because they obviously will undercut everybody. But there have been a lot of bookstores that have been really, really good to me. So I really like to support the independent bookstores. I mean, I know I'm not going to name them all, but, there's a couple culinary bookstores out in California that are carrying it that have been really good. There's one in San Francisco called Omnivore. There's another one in L.A. called Now Serving. There's Fountain Books in Richmond has been really good to me. Words Book in Maplewood, New Jersey. These are some of them. But anyway, you don't have to get them specifically from them. You can get IndieBound, and then IndieBound basically orders them from indie bookstores. But,
cool. So. I like the size. It's thin, small, but so much inside. So
yeah, it's easier for me to carry than my other books, and I like that.
So. Right. Okay, so listeners, you can carry it to your favorite sake bar,
yeah,
or Japanese restaurant. All right, so if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or akikoatm.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrationing happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter, enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.